Chapter 23 Alone on Olympus. Putin turned 60 in October 2012, reaching the official retirement age for Russian men. The limit had no bearing on the president or others holding high offices, but as president, Dmitry Medvedev had made a point of lowering the retirement age from 65. The idea was to rejuvenate the ranks of the bulging bureaucracy by making room for younger people to rise up. With his birthday approaching, and with some of his closest allies in government already having passed the milestone, Putin now raised the retirement age to 70. It seemed a minor adjustment, yet it was part of a pattern to reverse, step by step, whatever legacy Medvedev's presidency had left. In addition to the retirement age and the decriminalization of slander, Putin restored the two time zones that Medvedev had eliminated, and reversed his unpopular decision to stop changing the clocks twice a year. Medvedev's political reforms, announced as a concession amid the protests in the winter of 2011 to 2012, and signed into law as one of his last acts as president, were now diluted, so that elections for regional leaders would only involve candidates screened by the Kremlin. Although Medvedev remained prime minister and the leader of United Russia, the Kremlin seemed intent to airbrush him out of the pantheon of the country's leaders, as if Putin's presidency had never been interrupted. The Kremlin went so far as to belittle Medvedev's accomplishments, revising history in a Soviet style to emphasize Putin's ultimate responsibility for them. In August, on the fourth anniversary of the war in Georgia, a mysterious 47-minute documentary appeared on YouTube and began to circulate widely. It was called Lost Day, and quoting senior military commanders, it claimed that Medvedev's indecisiveness in the opening hours of the war had resulted in higher casualties among the Ossetian and Russian forces. This was black PR, a stealthy technique Russian media strategists had wielded to chilling effect against political opponents and business rivals. Only now it was turned on Putin's long-serving protege. The film's details were contradictory, blatantly false in places, simply muddled in others. The film's core assertion, set to eerie music, was that Medvedev caused the deaths of 1,000 people, even though the death toll from all sides in the war was 884. The harshest criticism in the film came from General Yuri Balayevsky, who, though he stepped down 2 months before the war began, claimed that the Georgians had launched their attack in South Ossetia hours before they actually had, and that Medvedev had acted only when Putin personally intervened from the Summer Olympics in Beijing. Until there was a kick in the backside, first from Beijing, then a kick personally from, as you say, directly Vladimir Vladimirovich, everyone, to put it mildly, was afraid of something, the general said. The source of the film never became clear, and no one claimed credit. In black PR, anonymity reigns. It was posted on a YouTube account belonging to someone named Aslan Gudiev and credited to a production company called Alpha, though no studio by that name existed in Russia. The Russian edition of Forbes linked the film to a television channel belonging to the National Media Group, partially owned and controlled by Bank Rossiya and its principal shareholder, Putin's old friend Yuri Kovalchuk. As it began to circulate, a reporter in the Kremlin press pool queried Putin, who went on to embrace much of what the film asserted, including the claim that he had called Medvedev twice from Beijing, thus directly contradicting the narrative his protege put forth. Given the Kremlin's tight control of questions from the press pool, the fact the question was even asked by a reporter from the state news agency RIA Novosti suggested that Putin wanted to draw attention to the film. He could easily have repudiated its worst insinuation about his old aide, his friend, and protege, but he did not. The infighting among the courtiers that preceded Putin's return to the presidency intensified after Medvedev pressed ahead with plans to privatize the state's shares in hundreds of companies, but found he had no more independent power to act than he did the previous 4 years. His rivals in Putin's court remained Sergei Ivanov, who was now the Kremlin's chief of staff, and Igor Sechin, and the other Siloviki, whose financial interests in the state enterprises had become even more pronounced. Medvedev had already declared that he would not rule out a run for the presidency again in 2018, a position that was said to anger others in the Kremlin, many of whom held him responsible for the protests that marred Putin's return. Only months into his term as prime minister, the film and the rollback of several of his initiatives eroded what little political standing Medvedev had. His prized project to build a Silicon Valley on the edge of Moscow suddenly faced criminal investigations on grounds that its executives had channeled money to the protest movement. Criticism of Medvedev's work as prime minister began filtering even into the Kremlin-friendly media, while Putin himself harshly criticized the government's budget and its slow pace at instituting the ambitious and exceedingly detailed, and, some said, largely symbolic, targets he decreed at the beginning of his new term to improve housing, early childhood education, scientific research, and life expectancy. The denigration of Medvedev's legacy extended to foreign affairs as well. Within days of his inauguration, Putin signaled that the reset championed by the Obama administration had ended. He brusquely informed the White House that he would not attend the G8 summit that would be held near Washington later that month, a rebuff not just to the United States, but also to the leaders of the other nations he had once courted. He sent Medvedev instead, on the pretext that he would be too busy forming the new government. No one in the White House welcomed Putin's return to the Kremlin, but Obama had sent his national security adviser, Thomas Donilon, to Moscow after his election, in hopes of securing Russia's support for continued reductions in nuclear weapons and for resolving the horrific civil war that had consumed Syria. In March, Obama, facing his own re-election campaign, had tried to reassure Medvedev that he and Putin could make progress overcoming Russia's opposition to missile defenses in Europe, but he needed to wait till after the election. Their exchange, at a meeting of world leaders on nuclear security, was inadvertently picked up on an open microphone. "On all these issues, but particularly missile defense, this can be solved, but it's important for him to give me space," Obama told Medvedev. "Yeah, I understand," Medvedev replied. "I understand your message about space. Space for you." "This is my last election," Obama explained. "After my election, I have more flexibility." "I understand. I will transmit this information to Vladimir." Obama's gaffe prompted his Republican challenger, Mitt Romney, to declare that Russia was our number one geopolitical foe, worse than a nuclear-armed North Korea or an aspiring nuclear power in Iran, because of the protection it provided to the world's worst actors through its veto at the United Nations Security Council. Obama misunderstood that while he might have more flexibility after his re-election, Putin would now be more inflexible than ever. By June, when Obama met Putin on the Baja California coast for the G20 summit, neither made much effort to conceal his disdain for the other. Putin kept Obama waiting for more than half an hour, and when the two emerged from their meeting, they did not smile or even speak to each other. Both stared at the floor as they answered journalists' questions. They also made no progress on any of the difficult issues dividing them, especially the worsening conflict in Syria. Obama's aides had drafted a plan to negotiate the exile of Syria's president, Bashar al-Assad, but it was based on the assumption that Assad would step down, and that Putin would persuade him to do so. Mindful of Medvedev's capitulation on Libya at the United Nations in 2011, Putin made it clear that he would not allow the United States to lead another foreign intervention to topple a sovereign leader, no matter how many lives would be lost in an increasingly brutal conflict. Assad's government remained one of Russia's last allies in the Middle East, a major weapons purchaser and the host of a Russian naval base on the Mediterranean at Tartus. But Putin's primary concern was to prevent the United States from, in his view, unleashing the forces of radicalism once again. Some officials in Washington and other capitals played down the anti-Americanism of Putin's political campaign as a cynical appeal to patriotic resistance against Russia's external enemies, but they misjudged how deeply it now shaped Putin's thinking. The palpable international disappointment that greeted his return to the presidency, the consternation over the harsh crackdown on the protests, the denunciations of the trials of Pussy Riot and the Bolotnia protesters, all served to harden Putin's view that the West was inimically opposed to him and his interests, and therefore inimically opposed to Russia itself. Putin's language now echoed the worst periods of the Cold War, endorsed and amplified by the circle of strongmen who dominated his cabinet, pushing to the margins the more moderate voices who had gathered around Medvedev. The restoration of foreign agents as an appellation suggested that the Kremlin now viewed human rights advocacy or efforts like Navalny's to enforce government accountability as a crime against state sovereignty. Navalny, after all, had participated at a graduate leadership fellowship at Yale University. That alone was grounds for suspicion now. In the summer of 2012, prosecutors had reopened a criminal investigation against Navalny, accusing him of embezzling $500,000 worth of timber in the Kirov region, while acting as an unpaid consultant to the region's government. It came a week after he had published evidence suggesting that the head of the investigative committee, Alexander Bastrykin, owned a business and apartment in the Czech Republic. Soon, the investigations expanded to other deals in which Navalny was involved, forcing him to spend more of his time and energies defending himself in court. The opposition to Putinism that had emerged in the winter of 2011 to 2012 slowly retreated from the streets, the rallies dwindling in size and fervor as the Kremlin pressed harder and harder against its critics. Putin's many opponents, the hamsters and hipsters, the creative classes who had rallied behind Navalny, retreated instead back to the internet, where they raged on helplessly. In September, in still another sign of Russia's deteriorating relations with the United States in particular, the Kremlin abruptly ended the work in Russia of the U.S. Agency for International Development. USAID had supported Golos and other civic organizations involved in politics, but also many other politically benign programs, including ones to develop home mortgages and to fight AIDS. In October, a new law expanded the definition of treason to include passing financial, material, and technical, consultative or other assistance to a foreign state or international organization. It was so broadly written that any critic of the government who now had contact with a foreign NGO could be charged as a traitor. Two prominent American organizations that supported election campaigns, the National Democratic Institute and the International Republican Institute, were forced to leave the country, as were similar groups from Europe, lest their employees or contacts face charges that could result in 20 years in prison. It became a tit-for-tat cycle, each action taken by one country replicated in the other. In 2012, the United States Congress, over the opposition of the White House, which still hoped to maintain a semblance of cooperation with Putin, adopted a new law named after Sergei Magnitsky, imposing travel bans and sanctions on Russian officials involved in his prosecution and death. American prosecutors ultimately traced some of the $230 million in illicit proceeds that Magnitsky had uncovered to four luxury condominiums and other commercial properties in Manhattan, and had a court seize them. They had been purchased by a real estate holding company in Cyprus, using money laundered through shell companies in the former Soviet Republic of Moldova. The Magnitsky Act infuriated Putin, who, while improbably denying knowledge of the details of Magnitsky's case, said that the United States would have sought to punish Russia regardless of the accountant's death in prison. "If Magnitsky did not exist," he said, they would have found another pretext. The Russians initially retaliated by imposing sanctions on 18 American officials involved in the detention and torture of prisoners at the Guantanamo Bay prison and elsewhere. Like the Soviet propagandists of the past, Putin had used these parallels, however misplaced at times, to deflect criticism of Russia. But now he went further. He proposed legislation that would place sanctions on American judges and officials involved in cases of abuse against adopted children from Russia, a subject of periodic tensions with the United States that seemed to have been resolved by a bilateral agreement to allow greater oversight of the process. Amid the furor over the Magnitsky sanctions, however, the Duma then went further still, passing legislation that would ban all adoptions of Russian children by Americans. The final vote was nearly unanimous, even though the legislation was so cynical and cruel that even members of Putin's government objected. Russia's orphanages were full of children in dire need of families, by some estimates as many as 800,000, in a country where adoption remained stigmatized and thus rare. Americans had adopted nearly 50,000 children since 1999. The ban would freeze some adoptions already in progress. Russia's retaliation was not symmetrical, but asymmetrical and self-inflicted. The Americans had targeted corrupt bureaucrats for sanctions. Russia was now targeting its own orphans. The day before the Duma's final vote on the bill, Putin faced unusually sharp questions during his annual press conference. He was asked 8 times why he would harm the interests of children in a political dispute with the United States. Putin lost his composure under the unexpected hostility of the questions, retorting angrily at one point that it was the United States that had been indifferent to the abuse of Russian adoptees. He claimed that American officials had rebuffed inquiries from Russian diplomats investigating instances where Russian children had been abused. "Do you think this is normal?" he fumed at one reporter. "How can it be normal when you are humiliated? Do you like it? Are you a masochist?" A week later, despite the unusual outpouring of protest at home, Putin signed the adoption ban into law. Putin's 60th birthday, on October 7, 2012, was celebrated across the nation in a manner befitting a cult of personality, something he always professed to find distasteful. No more, it seemed. In the days leading up to it, an exhibition of paintings was held in Moscow entitled, without irony, Putin, the Most Kind-Hearted Man in the World. A youth group affiliated with United Russia produced a 4-minute, sexually charged video of beautiful women reenacting his most famous exploits, from riding a horse in the mountains to flying in a fighter jet to driving a yellow Lada in Siberia. There were poetry readings and essay contests for schoolchildren. The milestone had special political resonance in Soviet history, where the fate of the leader and the country seemed inexorably intertwined. Stalin's 60th birthday in 1939 had been treated as a national holiday that overshadowed the Winter War with Finland. He was awarded the Order of Lenin Medal. Adolf Hitler even sent a telegram with his best wishes for the prosperous future of the peoples of the friendly Soviet Union. Nikita Khrushchev received the same award on his 60th birthday in 1954, while Leonid Brezhnev was given the honor of Hero of the Soviet Union upon his. Putin's 60th came with no medals, and there was something hollow in the fanfare. Despite the official adulation, there was an intangible sense of trepidation among both his supporters and his critics, a realization of his age and mortality, a feeling that he had become indispensable, but that no one could be forever. In September, he appeared at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in Vladivostok with a visible limp that the Kremlin seemed unwilling to explain clearly. He had pulled a muscle in his back while playing ice hockey, which he had recently taken up, one senior aide later explained. After a tumultuous year, Putin had survived the wave of marches that sullied his re-election, but the uncertainty involving his health revealed a disquiet coursing through the system. The leader seemed to be struggling to regain the verve of his first presidency. It was as if he had returned to power with no clear goal, as if his election had been not a means to an end, but the end itself. On his way to the summit, he had flown on a motorized glider as part of a conservation program to return endangered Siberian cranes to the wild. Putin had charmed his supporters with various encounters with wild animals, some of them sedated, but his choreographed stunts no longer seemed convincing. He had stopped during the upheaval around his election, perhaps embarrassed by his discovery of the planted amphorae in the Black Sea, but now they had resumed, his strategists returning to the tactics that had worked for so long. Putin dressed in a willowy white jumpsuit and joined the glider's pilot to lead cranes raised in captivity near the River Ob in western Siberia toward their winter resting ground to the south. The aircraft, equipped with cameras, had to make two attempts before the birds would follow. Putin had reportedly paid for the glider and spent hours training for the flight, but the event was ridiculed as a 21st century form of Soviet hagiography. Gleb Pavlovsky, the strategist who had fallen out of favor, described Putin's latest stunts as reflexive and unconvincing, as if the Kremlin had run out of new ideas. Pavlovsky had done as much as anyone to shape Putin's political image through the television stunts that had made him the political leader he became, but having returned to office, Putin seemed to know no other way to lead. Rather than drawing attention to conservation issues, the cranes now were simply another prop for Putin's vanity. "The leader went to the movies and never came back," Pavlovsky said. He sounded contrite. The hagiography continued on Putin's birthday itself. While he celebrated privately with close friends and family at the official residence in Petersburg, all the state television channels organized special programming. On Russia's weekly news program, Dmitry Kisilov compared him to Stalin and meant it as a compliment. In terms of the scope of his activities, Putin as a politician is among his predecessors in the 20th century comparable only to Stalin, he said in a 13-minute encomium that managed to mention rising salaries and pensions, the revival of the army, and the restoration of nuclear parity with the United States. NTV broadcast a 50-minute documentary that attempted to reintroduce a man who almost alone had been at the center of public attention for 12 years. Called Visiting Putin, it breathlessly claimed to show Putin as only his closest circle knew him, though it offered little at all that was new. The presenter, Vadim Takhmayenev, followed the president through a week at work, from his office at Nova Agareva to the Kremlin to a presidential visit to Tajikistan. In a series of interviews conducted over the week, Putin simply restated his views on his election, his critics, corruption, and foreign policy, dismissing criticisms as mere annoyances. The leaders of the protest movement, people like Navalny, whose name Putin never seemed able to utter, were the chaff that would fall away, he said, and make room for truly charismatic and interesting people to emerge in public life and politics. Corruption was overstated, and anyway, the average annual income for Russians had risen from less than $1,000 a year when he took office to nearly $10,000 now. It is extremely important for the self-perception of any person living in this territory that he should realize that he is not just living in this territory, but that he is a citizen of a strong, powerful state which enjoys the respect of the world. The most important thing, he too said, was that only Russia had strategic nuclear parity with the United States. Putin's answer ignored the daily humiliation and anger of Russians forced to pay bribes for virtually any public service, the high graft that Navalny made a specialty of exposing, the dismal rankings of Transparency International that placed Russia 133rd out of 176 countries. Only 2 days before, NTV had aired a documentary accusing the protesters who took to the streets of conspiring to overthrow the government, this time with the assistance of oligarchs in Georgia and their patrons in the West. The paired documentaries portrayed Putin as a simple, honest patriot at work, tirelessly, exclusively devoted to the affairs of state, while his critics were aliens who wanted anarchy. Amid the compounding evidence of corruption and cronyism that had enriched his friends and allies, Putin was shown living a modest, almost ascetic life in a residence that, for all its comfort and amenities, was spare, with few ostentatious displays of wealth. The latest white paper by Boris Nemtsov and his allies on the corruption and wealth of Putin's inner circle had detailed the 20 state residences the president had at his disposal, 9 of them built during his time in power, as well as dozens of yachts and aircraft. Yet even these critics acknowledged that Putin cared less about the trappings of wealth than about those of power. Although reverential, visiting Putin did provide a sketch of the official presidential routine that in the 12 years since Yeltsin's resignation had by design remained something of a mystery to ordinary Russians. Putin's days were scripted into what seemed a passionless series of meetings and ceremonies. He began his morning late, waking at 8:30 on the second day of Takhmayanov's project with his briefing folders, the daily compilations by the FSB and the Foreign Intelligence Service, the SVR. Then, as on most days, he had a prolonged workout, first on the weight machines in the residence's gymnasium, watching television news programs, and then a kilometer swim in its indoor pool. It was noon before Putin ate breakfast, a simple meal of porridge, raw quail eggs, and cottage cheese, sent to him, he noted, by Patriarch Kirill from the church's own farms, and a juice from beets and horseradish. His working day, therefore, began late and lasted into the deepest night. His meetings with ministers often occurred when most people were already preparing for bed. It was nearly midnight one evening when he dismissed Takhmayanov in order to meet his anti-drug chief, Viktor Ivanov, and the Minister of Defense, Anatoly Serdyukov, who, like Takhmayanov, had to wait in the antechamber. Putin said his ministers were always on call, but he would only disturb them when he had to. When asked, he said he distrusted the mass media as biased, a curious admission given the Kremlin's obsessive control of virtually all channels. He claimed to prefer the information he received from his meetings with his men, like Serdyukov and Ivanov, which he considered much more complete and much more accurate. The desk in his office had no computer linking him to the internet where, were he so inclined, he might find information that would challenge what had become a circumscribed worldview, reinforced by the courtiers who rarely dared to challenge him. Despite the adulatory tone, the documentary, like another one in German timed to coincide with his inauguration 5 months before, managed to be revealing nevertheless. They both showed him surrounded constantly by his aides and guards, but no one else. He worked out alone. He swam alone. He ate breakfast alone. No one from his family appeared in either film, neither his wife nor his daughters, Maria, who was then 27, and Katya, who was 26, nor did any of his friends. His closest companion seemed to be his black Labrador, Coney, who waited poolside as he completed his laps. In NTV's film, the only sign of Medvedev, once his closest aide and still his prime minister, came when Putin pointed out a red tandem bicycle parked forlornly outside the gym. It had been a gift from Medvedev, Putin explained, while working out on the weights, obviously as a joke. It did not seem to be used. One television critic thought the loneliness of the leader was an improbable invention, intended to convince viewers that he was not the corrupt, insensitive figure that the protesters made him out to be, but rather the dedicated public servant sacrificing himself for the nation. Putin's personal life still remained a closely guarded secret to all but those who knew him best, a small and discreet circle, one that had been remarkably consistent over the years, but also one that was increasingly insular. Everything Russians learned about Putin's life, they learned like this, in small, measured glimpses that the Kremlin arranged or allowed to appear, always circumscribed, occasionally insightful. Putin's penchant for working late at night and keeping visitors waiting for hours had become notorious. Even his friends would wait to meet him in the wee hours. Igor Shadchan, the filmmaker who had interviewed him 2 decades before, recalled meeting Putin the last time at 1 o'clock in the morning, after waiting for hours as a line of officials and executives filed one at a time into Putin's office. Putin no longer had the easy banter that had won Shadchan over in 1991. He tried to tell a joke, but Putin did not laugh. "By the way," he said in an interview in 2013, "Stalin was also a night person." Echoing Solzhenitsyn's dramatization of Stalin's interior monologues in The First Circle, Shadchan now described Putin as terribly tired and lonely, rigid in his dogma, distrusting and afraid even of those in his entourage who would want revenge as soon as he steps down because many of them are humiliatingly dependent on him. Those who had once occupied the outer orbits of Putin's life, ministers, businessmen, acquaintances, now met him less frequently. He seemed to have changed. German Greff, one of his liberal advisors since their days working together in Petersburg, had watched his old colleague for so long, but nevertheless struggled to explain the evolution of his character. Asked once if Putin had changed, he paused uncomfortably, searching for an answer that would not offend. All he would say was, "Power changes people." Others who had been close found themselves excluded. Anatoly Sobchak's widow, Lyudmila Narusova, described Putin as a man who had changed from the time when her husband could jokingly call him Stierlitz, the double agent in the spy serial 17 Moments in Spring. "He has a good sense of humor. At least he used to," she told a newspaper after being ousted from the Federation Council in the fall of 2012. Her political exile was the price she paid for being a rare voice of opposition to the flurry of laws cracking down on protesters, her daughter Ksenia among them. "The destruction of illusions that I have does not involve Vladimir Vladimirovich, whom I know to be an absolutely honest, decent, and devoted person, but to his entourage," Narusova said. "I have a feeling of disgust towards those he surrounds himself with." He had grown blind to the very low moral standards of the political leaders he relied on. "Is it possible they do not understand, small, fussy, and greedy as they are, that once they lie, they can never restore confidence again? They lie to each other, they lie to him, but nevertheless, he relies on them." She said that in power, a certain bronzivania happens, using the word for bronzing, that suggests an inflated sense of self-importance, hardening like a monument into something less than human. She recalled Sobchak's last meeting with Putin when he headed to Kaliningrad to campaign for his election in 2000. "Volodya," he warned Putin, "don't become bronzed." And yet bronzed he seemed to have become. As prime minister, Putin had continued to live in his official residence in Nova Agareva, but by the time he returned to the presidency, he was living alone. The oldest daughter, Maria, had married a Dutchman, Jorrit Fassen, who joined the executive ranks of Gazprom. His connection to the Putin family filtered into the public consciousness only after he was involved in a road rage incident in November 2010, while driving his BMW on the traffic-clogged highway coursing through Rublyovka, the billionaire-studded suburb of Moscow's elite. After a near collision with a Mercedes carrying a young banker, Matvey Urin, several bodyguards piled out of a trailing Volkswagen van and beat Fassen badly. The attack was investigated not by the traffic police, but by the Presidential Security Service. And within weeks, not only were the bodyguards arrested, but so too was Urin. He was convicted of battery and sentenced to 4.5 years in prison, compounded by subsequent convictions for embezzlement and fraud that dismantled his banking empire. Jorrit and Maria married in secrecy. It was never exactly clear when or where though there were rumors of a ceremony on a Greek island. And in 2012, not long before Putin's 60th birthday, they had a son. Putin became a grandfather, a fact that was never reported in the Russian press. Even less was known about Putin's younger daughter, Katya, who was said to have majored in Asian studies at university. She was long rumored to be dating the son of a South Korean admiral, even to have married him, though that turned out not to be true. She took up competitive dancing, becoming vice president of the World Rock and Roll Confederation under the name Katerina Vladimirovna Tikhonova, the family name evidently taken from the patronymic of Lyudmila's mother. At the end of 2012, at the age of 26, she became the director of the National Intellectual Development Fund, an organization building a $1.6 billion high-tech research center on the grounds of Moscow State University. The fund's trustees included several of Putin's closest allies, now wealthy executives of state enterprises, including Igor Sechin and Sergei Chemezov. It was said she had married Kirill Shamalov, the son of Nikolai Shamalov, who had been a member of Putin's Azura Dacha cooperative. Kirill, too, had joined the executive ranks of Gazprom after graduating from the same university as Katerina. He then became an executive and ultimately a shareholder at Sibur, the country's largest petrochemical company, then owned in part by Gennady Timchenko. The interlocking, nepotistic ties of Putin's circle of friends and allies seemed to be trickling down to a new generation. In the absence of official or even reliable information about the Putins' private lives, rumors festered, mostly in the more gossipy or conspiratorial quarters of the internet. There was speculation about Lyudmila's health, including bouts of depression or addiction. A favorite tale had her living in a monastery near Pskov, banished as the wives of czars had been throughout history. The truth was more pedestrian. Sergei Roldugin, one of Putin's oldest friends, said that the Putins had remained cordial, but had grown increasingly distant. Putin instead spent more time with the same circle of friends he had kept from his childhood, from the KGB, and from the businesses that took root in the 1990s. It was among these friends that Putin would relax, hosting late-night parties at his residence in Moscow, or the official retreats that Boris Nemtsov detailed in his report on the presidential holdings. In these gatherings, Roldugin said, he never discussed business openly. Those talks happened personally, one-on-one, and rarely politics. The discussions increasingly ranged through history and literature. Putin's interest could wane. He had little patience for tired subjects, but a thirst for new information. Roldugin revealed how, after reading Pasternak's translation of King Lear, Putin quizzed his friends on whether they knew, as Pasternak wrote in his comments on the translation, that the historical inspiration for the tale dated to the 9th century. He would invite singers, preferring crooners like Grigory Leps and Philippe Kirkorov, for private concerts. The guests, even the host, would arrive at all hours by car or helicopter. He once asked Roldugin to bring musicians from the House of Music in Petersburg, where his old friend now served as artistic director. The three musicians, a violinist, a pianist, and a clarinetist, played Mozart, Weber, and Tchaikovsky. Putin was moved and, with the grace of a czar, invited them to play again the next night for the same small group of friends. These gatherings included the likes of Yuri Kovalchuk and Gennady Timchenko, but less and less often Putin's wife. Putin's obsessions remained work and sport. Ice hockey became a new hobby in 2011 after he attended a youth tournament. It was a sport that also occupied his friends Timchenko and the brothers Rotenberg, Boris and Arkady, who owned professional teams in Russia's Continental Hockey League. Putin spent hours learning to skate and handle a stick, an indication of the same zeal he showed in learning martial arts as a teenager, and soon was playing in games in arenas emptied of all but invited guests. His teammates and tutors were some of hockey's legends, like Slava Fetisov and Pavel Bura. as well as friends like the Rotenbergs, his own government ministers, and even the Belarusian president, Alexander Lukashenko. The bodyguards from his security detail and Medvedev's, though not Medvedev himself, filled out the squads. In the run-up to the Olympics, Putin decreed the creation of an amateur night league for men over 40, which expanded to include players of all ages. He saw it as part of the revitalization of the country through sports and fitness. The amateur games were soon open to the public and featured in news reports that breathlessly tracked the president's growing prowess on the ice. Wearing number 11, he scored with astounding ease, 6 goals in 1 game. He was playing hockey, he said dismissively, on the night of the first mass protests in December 2011. On the day he was inaugurated in 2012, he left the Kremlin as the new president to play in an exhibition match against retired hockey legends with 2 retired politicians, Silvio Berlusconi and Gerhard Schroeder, among the spectators. Putin scored 2 goals, including the game winner on a penalty shot in overtime. It was on Putin's inauguration day that May that Ludmila was last seen with him in public. Before that, they had appeared together on election day at a polling station, where Putin pointedly joked at her expense. As a worker pointed out the candidate information posted on the wall, Putin replied that he did not need it, but that she might. "She's not up to speed," he said. Her absence in the new Putin presidency became striking, fueling new rumors of their separation. She was conspicuously absent at Easter services that year, when Putin appeared with Medvedev and his wife, accompanied by the mayor of Moscow, Sergei Sobyanin. Putin also avoided her 55th birthday on the eve of Orthodox Christmas on January 6, 2013. He was in Sochi, granting Gerard Depardieu a passport so the actor could avoid paying taxes in France and skiing at the newly groomed Olympic slopes. They did not appear together in public again until the following June, when they emerged after the first of 3 acts of a ballet being performed at the Kremlin, La Esmeralda, to answer a question from a journalist so impertinent that it could only have been as orchestrated as the performance they were attending. "How did you like Esmeralda?" the waiting correspondent from the all-news channel, Russia 24, began. After Putin and his wife made a few banal observations about the beautiful music and airy movements of the dancers, the correspondent then gently broached a subject that would have, under any other circumstance, provoked Putin's fury. "You so rarely appear together, and there are rumors that you do not live together. Is that so?" Putin inhaled, glanced at Ludmila, and after a moment answered, "It's true. All of my activity, my work, is public, absolutely public. Some like it, others do not. Some are absolutely incompatible with it." He addressed her formally as Lyudmila Alexandrovna, the way one would speak to a stranger or an elder. She was done keeping watch, he said. "It's been 8 years, or 9, yes, 9, so, to sum it up, it was a mutual decision." They stood slightly, awkwardly apart. Lyudmila appeared pained, Putin steely. "Our marriage is over because we barely see each other," she injected. "Vladimir Vladimirovich is engrossed in his work. Our children have grown up, they live their own lives. We all do." She expressed gratitude that he was still supporting me and our children, and said they would remain friends. At a time when many Russian politicians and officials were fighting off revelations about their children living or studying abroad, Putin seized the opportunity to emphasize the point that their daughters had remained in Russia. The correspondent seemed confused. Did this mean they were actually divorcing? "You can call it a civilized divorce," Ludmila said. Putin's decision to lift the veil on his personal life coincided with the socially conservative turn of his policies, trumpeting Russian faith and morality in the struggle to define and defend the idea of the state. For the most part, Russians reacted with indifference, even sympathy. The only surprise was the timing. the divorce would not become official until the next year. Their separation, meanwhile, prompted a flurry of speculation that Putin was preparing to remarry, perhaps to Alina Kabayeva, who was rumored to have had his son in 2010, and a daughter in 2012. Kabayeva, who appeared on the cover of the Russian edition of Vogue in January 2011, wearing a dazzling Balmain dress, repeatedly denied that she had children. A boy who had appeared in her life, she said, was her nephew. Rumors of other affairs emerged, involving the sleeper spy Anna Chapman and Putin's official photographer Yana Lapikova, a former model and a contestant in a Miss Moscow pageant. There was always something a little hollow about the rumors, all of which Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, denied. Stanislav Belkovsky, the political strategist and occasional columnist, claimed the rumors of a love life were themselves the invention of the Kremlin's PR machine, floated to enhance Putin's image. Belkovsky published a book in Germany that portrayed him as a lonely, distrustful leader, closer to his pet dogs than to any people, even among his friends. The book, simply titled Putin, blended speculation, hearsay, and fact, including accurate details, for example, about the daughters' lives, so seamlessly that it was impossible to distinguish one from the other, much as it was impossible to know the truth of Putin's private life. Even Belkovsky was not sure, however, distancing himself from the psychological portrait he had drawn. Putin seemed no more genuine than any of the political stunts he had perfected. After more than 12 years in the public spotlight, he had become a more distant figure, as remote from the people as the general secretaries or czars before him, as powerful and unknowable as the elusive authority Klam in Kafka's The Castle. "You know, it's not about Putin anymore," Gleb Pavlovsky said. "We talk about Putin too much. Putin is our zero, a void, a screen where we project our desires, love, hate."